Just before we came live with you, we were in the kind of green room chatting, and Scott was saying what a privilege it is for us to be in this business of working with consciousness and awareness. And it is. Yeah, and thank you, Scott, for reminding us that it's a privilege. So this is the sixth of the Compassion Dialogues. And they're hosted by the UK Register of Spiritual Caregivers, which comes under the umbrella of the Spiritual Companions Trust. And in this conversation, very, very lucky. Thank you so much, Sarah, for agreeing to join us. Do you want to bring her in beside me, Scott? And so it's really wonderful that we have Sarah Eager with us for this conversation. We were trying to remember when our paths would have crossed, and they would have crossed any time in the last 30, 40 years, actually, where spirituality and psychology, psychotherapy, meditation, spirituality, psychology were kind of intertwining. We were there on other sides of the room. So it's wonderful she's come to join us, because she's one of those people who has, I'll say it now, I think, Sarah, you know, you reassure people in the spirituality camp that there's hope and service and compassion in medicine and psychiatry. And you reassure people in the medicine and psychiatry camp that there's wisdom and groundedness and rigor and intelligence in the spirituality camp. Despite the fact that we both know they're bonkers people in both sides, in actual fact, right? Let me just, for the record, Sarah was a medical student in Melbourne, then came to the UK, became a psychiatrist, and has been on the executive committee or been chair of the Special Interest Group on Spirituality at the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the Religion, Spirituality and Psychiatry section of the World Psychiatric Association, past chair of the National Spirituality and Mental Health Forum and of the British Holistic Medical Association, and is currently chair of the Janki Foundation, which merges spiritual practice and mental health well-being. So Sarah, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us. Very grateful. And I mean, very personal for a moment. I said earlier on, people would die for your skin tone and complexion. You know, every time I see you, I think it's a miracle of how well you look after yourself. So there's something grounded there, quite in parallel with the spiritual practice. So listen, let's kick off. Tell us, if you would, a little bit about your childhood, who your parents were, where you were brought up, and what kind of led you towards medicine in the very first place, if you would.
Thanks, William, and good evening, everyone. It's a great honour to be invited to speak on this very special Compassion Dialogue. So William and I did have a little chat before today, just to fill in some gaps. And, you know, we're often used to just talking about my professional life. And he said, do you mind if I ask you some more personal questions? I said, not at all. Sure, I'm really happy to share a bit about my life, because I guess that's really what interests us about other people, isn't it? When we hear their story and their journey. So I was born in London, actually, and this is where I live now. So it's interesting to sort of be back in the place where, if you like, I incarnated. My parents were in the healthcare profession. My father trained as a doctor at St. Thomas's, and my mum was a nurse at St. Mary's Hospital. And in fact, I ended up back at St. Mary's. That's where my first consultant post was at St. Mary's. So there is some kind of feeling of circles being closed there. They emigrated to Australia when I was three. And so I did have an experience there, in a way, of being an immigrant family, being a family separated from its family of origin, if you like. So I heard a lot of stories about England and grandparents and cousins and aunties and uncles, but I'd never met them. So I went to school in Australia, went to boarding school. I noticed Paul Gilbert talked about that last time. So I had that experience as well, studied medicine. And I think my dad was a good role model for me. He was a very kind country GP, very much part of the community. And I think from early teens, I had a feeling that whatever I did, I would like to be in a profession that helped other people. That was quite an important motivator for me. And so, yeah, did my medical student training in Australia, and as all good Australians do after that, wanted to travel and came to London and started doing psychiatry locums and felt, oh, this is quite interesting, psychiatry and the way the mind works and things like that were of interest to me. So that's I started doing psychiatry.
Can you tell us how you actually, it's a big decision for young doctors when they choose their speciality. You know, it's a big decision. So how did you, what led you to choosing that path?
Well, I think that's something that I often say to medical students. You know, you start doing medicine, but it's like people say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And for doctors, it's what kind of doctor do you want to be when you grow up? Because there are so many different branches and paths. And I think we talked about this, William, but my own spiritual journey really started when I was a medical student, and I started doing meditation then. And so my interest in the psyche, if you like, or the soul, was definitely peaked then. But they were really quite separate parts of my life, I would say, because the psychiatry I did as a medical student was pretty, would you say, uninspiring, maybe. It was very much the institutional kind of model, and when I first came to England and practiced, it was again the big mental health hospitals. I was at Free and Barnet. That was pretty scary too, I have to say.
So listen, let me pause you because I want to go back a bit, rewind a little bit in order to understand how having had some spiritual experiences as a medical student, how that then made it okay for you to go into the psychiatric profession, because what you're just saying is it was a bit clunky and not really your cup of tea. But so let's just rewind a little bit. And what actually happened to you as a medical student that made you open up to spirituality?
Well, interestingly enough, and I think we shared similar experiences on that. As it's now become much more in the news in psychiatry, I had a very powerful experience on magic mushrooms. So it was a psilocybin trip, and I had a kind of a trance-like experience where I remember saying to myself, "Oh, this is what Jesus is talking about." I remember thinking that, and I felt I died. But then I had this sort of peak experience where I was seeing a four-armed figure like Vishnu on a lotus flower, and I really hadn't been exposed to Indian mythology or Indian culture or religion at all. So this was quite an amazing vision in a way to have. And as I was coming out of that, I was communicating with animals and birds and nature, and just it was all pretty full on spiritual experience. And that led me to realize there's something inside of me that I need to tap into, but I didn't want to have to keep taking drugs to do that. So that's when I was reading Patanjali's Raja Yoga and different things, and tried to find a meditation path that would help me have the same insights and realizations and experiences. And that's when I came across the Brahma Kumaris in Australia. A friend of mine had met them in London, and then they came to Australia, and I connected and did their meditation course. And for me, it resonated very deeply and made a lot of sense. And so I started practicing what they call Raja Yoga meditation, and have really done that ever since. And but as you said in your introduction, I felt it was so in some ways off the wall to mainstream medicine. I didn't really talk about it much. And I guess the main thing that people would notice about me was that I was vegetarian. That was sort of the thing that marked me out as different from other people at that point. Obviously not so unusual now, but then it was, are you mad kind of.
Yeah. Listen, the couple of reference points there, which I think might be very helpful and interesting for folk. One, the second one will be to tell people who the Brahma Kumaris are, because you've named them. But prior to that, the mushroom psychotropic experience that you had, I think it'll be helpful for people, especially if they have no experience of them and maybe perhaps are even a little bit suspicious of them, to just know, were you in town, were you in landscape when it happened? Had you taken it as a kind of for fun? Had you taken it consciously? Was it serendipitous what happened to you? Ooh.
I was in staying with some friends near the sea in very beautiful surroundings, and I think they were hippies, I suppose, really, and so it was done as a consciousness raising thing. So it was a very safe environment and very beautiful, and it felt like the right kind of environment. But it was, I don't know if you heard the Today program, but this morning David Nutt was interviewed, and he was talking about this because they've just done some research about how what's the effect of psilocybin, that it loosens up the brain, they say, and so in a way it helps people who are depressed. It can really break through stuck patterns of thinking and things like that. And I just find it interesting that, I don't know, 40 years on, well, 40 plus years on, something that was a great spiritual awakening for me is now being sort of used in mainstream,
Yeah.
coming to be used in mainstream medicine and seriously studied. So I think it's.
A friend of mine once called mushrooms the avatars of the plant kingdom.
Well, I mean, it's not, I think it's not something that I would recommend people do lightly. I think, you need a very safe, containing environment and someone who understands what's going on for you. And it sounds like that's what they're trying to replicate in these medical situations, although I'd much rather be on a beach in Australia than in a clinic. But I think for people who have gone through, are very, very stuck in their way of thinking, it does offer some hope. So I keep an open mind about it.
Yeah, I do remember those 30, 40 years ago when they were experimenting with LSD as a therapeutic drug. They did understand that it needed to be done out in nature. And they lost patience to the trees. So tell people who the Brahma Kumaris are, because some folk may not have heard of them.
This is an organization that was started in what was then Sindh or in Pakistan in 1936, and a gentleman had a series of visions and some what we would call channelings, I think. Some wisdom came through him, and they started a community where women were put in the forefront, and it was a small community that eventually moved after partition from Pakistan to Mount Abu in India. And now they're a worldwide organization of men and women. I'm not even sure how many there are actually worldwide now, William, to be fair, but many thousands. And they call themselves a spiritual university, so they teach a fairly universal, or well, a universal form of spiritual knowledge and meditation. And their services are always free. They feel that spiritual knowledge is not something you should have to pay for. So that's their platform.
Does their meditation practice have a particular style to it?
Yes, I mean, their focus, and this was always an important thing for me, is that they have an understanding that there is a source of light and love, supreme soul, if you like, divine love, ocean of compassion, God, whatever word you want to put on it, that soul is available to all of us if we direct our minds towards that energy. And the Raj is the highest, and the yoga is connection. So it's a feeling in meditation of connecting with that energy of love and compassion, and getting help from that energy, and strength and power too.
That's a whole conversation for me. Maybe we can push it in at the end, which is how mindfulness has tended to put meditation forward as a secular, self-soothing activity. Whereas we know, those of us who've practiced meditation for decades, we know that it's a spiritual
Yes.
practice, because when you meditate and go into the silence, you connect with, as you said, supreme consciousness, God, what goddess, whatever you call it. That's the experience. Anyway, listen, fast forward, we're back at St. Mary's, and some,
Can I
sorry.
add something in there
Yeah,
before?
of course. Yeah.
Because this was a really critical thing for me about, did that energy, was it a figment of my imagination, or did it really exist? And about 3 months into learning meditation, I remember thinking, well, if that energy is just a fantasy, I'm not sure if I can be bothered sticking with this. And I had a very powerful experience where I was kind of pulled into a dimension of light, of red light, and I could see that energy was in front of me, and it had kind of like moving rays. And I can remember thinking, oh, you look like an octopus. And but in my mind, I was saying, gosh, you're real, you really exist. And it replied to me sort of mentally as well, saying, yes, I do, I am here. It's never happened to me since, but it was a very profound experience, which made me aware. I mean, I knew I was awake, and I knew I wasn't taking substances, that it was in clear consciousness that energy does exist and you can connect with it. So that's been really powerful.
I can't help but say, I would hope and imagine that in every meditation, people are, in one way or another, sensing a connection with that.
Yes,
So,
yes.
some, sometimes deep and strong, and sometimes
Yeah.
little and at a distance, you know.
Yeah, I just meant in that kind of 3D, yes, visionary way.
Just make sure she gets it, chirps. She's not
Absolutely.
quite certain.
Yeah.
Tell her for certain. So listen, so you have that thread in you. You also have the thread of an instinct for caring, which takes you into medicine. In order to do medicine, though, one has to have a brain that can deal with science, because it's biology and chemistry, and some physics usually, but always biology and chemistry, you know. So you've got biology, chemistry, science, you've got seeking to care, you've got the spiritual thread, and then you've got the locums you did in psychiatry, which I think in your own words were kind of clunky. So how come you kept sniffing in that direction and didn't, for example, go towards obstetrics or, you know, something other?
I think I just felt that the area of study of thoughts and emotions and thinking was something that the spiritual exploration had taken me towards as well. So there was a synchronicity of, or a general subject area that I was interested in. And it was just the way it unfolded, the connections I had, the people who put me in touch with others to get jobs, and the training program is very interesting, and they look after you from beginning to end. So I was just sort of following a thread, really, and it felt right, I suppose. I found psychiatry quite confusing, and I think we talked about this because after a while I realized actually there's no such thing as psychiatry really. There's just lots of different models, and every place I trained, people were working from a slightly different model or a different perspective. And so there are many different kinds of psychiatry. And also, it became clear to me they didn't really know what the self was. They didn't understand consciousness, or it was just an epiphenomenon of brain activity. And so I could see that there was something to contribute to that field as well.
Because a lot of people in the holistic spiritual world have quite a profound suspiciousness of psychiatry, partly through misinformation. They've heard too many bad stories, and partly because quite often people have friends who were having a spiritual crisis at birth, which then got diagnosed as looking like psychosis, and then they got sedated, and they were not dealt with knowledgeably or caringly or compassionately, and then meant psychiatric wards in general was there were all sorts of stories about the cruelties and stupidities in them, and then there was the lobotomy stuff and all that kind of stuff. So you were coming into quite a culture that was full of villains as well as philosophical heroes, explorers of consciousness.
No, you're right. It's very varied indeed, and at times quite an uncomfortable place to be. And I eventually, interestingly, found myself in, I ended up in old age psychiatry. I enjoyed very much my time at the Tavistock, and that the psychotherapeutic way of looking at things, and obviously Jung is interesting. So that's more leaning. But I in fact ended up doing research in Alzheimer's disease, and I enjoyed being with older people, and I found dementia really interesting as well, because I had a strong sense of, even though the brain was beginning to fail and not operating properly, that the spirit was still very strong and still alive. And I felt it, I like to connect with that aspect of people, beyond language and beyond brain function, if you like. So
Oh, that's opening up to a wonderful conversation. But let me just stay with your story for the moment. So you steered away from that part of psychiatry that's interested in medication and possible surgical interventions and stuff, and you moved into an area where you could just be a human being with another human being.
more so, I would say, and you obviously, well, I think in a lot of psychiatry you work in teams, but in old age psychiatry you definitely work in a team. You need a whole team of people in that field of psychiatry. But in fact, it was also my entry into that was a research project. I was looking at one of the first possible treatments for Alzheimer's, and so we were scanning lots of brains. So I did a lot of stuff in brain scanning and brain function and cognitive function as well. But it all it just underlined for me the sense that we are spiritual beings and we manifest through our brains, and our brain is really just filtering that spiritual energy out into the world, so that we can communicate or we can act or we can interact and things like that. Because all that study, all those scans, nothing was able to pinpoint and say, well, this is where that experience of the self is. This is, when I say I, what do I, what's the I that's speaking? What's the I that's observing, that's witnessing, that's has the gestalt, really, that brings the fact that we experience our lives and reality, if you like, in real time. All integrated is a miracle. If you think about all the bits, the vision, the sound, the language, the subconscious, all those things are integrated, and we don't experience as a disintegrated mess. we experience it as an integrated reality in the present moment. It's amazing.
So what did the other psychiatrists in your teams think of you, or did you keep quiet about your perspective?
I tended to keep fairly quiet, but I think if now's an appropriate time to mention it, when the spirituality special interest group started at the Royal College, I think that was quite a milestone for a lot of us, because it was sort of like coming out almost really. And then we realized there were lots of other people, other psychiatrists who actually had a spiritual life or a life of faith, and that they too were feeling a bit hidden away, or that they didn't have a voice. So
What year was that? Do you remember?
think it was 1998 or something like that. Oh no, it must have been before that. I'm actually, yeah, I can't remember what
Yeah.
year it was, but maybe very early 1990s or late 1980s.
So let me just tell people that at the end of our conversation, I will post in the chat box some links that Sarah prepared for us that people will find useful. And one of the links is to the Royal College of Psychiatry's Spirituality Interest Group, which people can join even if you're not a psychiatrist or medical creature. Isn't that right?
I don't think you can. No.
I joined a while ago, and I'm not.
Oh,
Oh, you get access to the papers.
you can get access to
Maybe
things.
that's what I mean.
You can get access to the website, and actually, I wrote an online CPD module about exploring patients'
Yeah.
spirituality, and that's free. Anyone can access that, because we paid for it to make sure that it could be open access.
So, people who are listening to this, you need reassuring that if you go to the Royal College of Psychiatry's website, you can go to the Spirituality Special Interest Group, and you can get access to the papers and Sarah's CPD, Continuing Professional Development course on giving compassion and care and spirituality and mental health. But somebody told me, and you were going to check, but you've probably forgotten, that there were actually it was actually it's actually the largest interest group in the Royal College, and somebody once told me there were up 3,000 plus members of it.
No, I did check with
I did
you.
you? Oh,
I do what I'm told.
the request.
I checked with Chris Cook, our chair,
Yeah.
and he said at the last count it was between 4,600 and 5,000 in a college membership of about 20,000. So that's about one in five or one in four
Yeah.
psychiatrists.
I hope everybody listening gets this, that one in four UK shrinks is in the spirituality interest group. I mean, it's a really interesting little hint at the kind of people who go into medicine and then become psychiatrists.
Yes, and there's obviously a wide range of belief systems within that group. There are Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, spiritual but not religious, and lots of other faiths. So it's a very broad church, and that's why it's interesting. I think in America they tend to focus more on religion, but I think this group was very clear, and Andrew Powell was the founding chair, was that it should really be focused on spirituality, which was gave the broadest, most inclusive kind of definition and membership.
So if I were to dare to try and guess at what the core tenets that keep this group together are, let me try and see what you think. What one would be that psychiatric care needs to be compassionate, and the second would be that the psyche bit of psychiatrist, the psyche in a human being, has a dimension to it that is more than just the brain and nervous system.
Yeah.
Would that be a kind of fair
Yeah, I think it's that, in a holistic model, mind, body, spirit, that you need to take into account all those aspects of people's existence. And that's been a kind of ongoing dialogue with other members of the college, if you like, because I think now psychiatry is really trying hard to be person-centered. It's trying very hard to be compassionate and sort of, they talk about a bio-psychosocial model of psychiatry and cultural. They will put cultural in there now. But we would argue very strongly for a bio-psychosocial spiritual cultural model. And so for some people, that is a step too far. They say you don't have evidence that we're spiritual beings, that we're souls. And so then so consciousness is kind of up for grabs in a way. But the idea, I think what we try to get across more than anything is that for the vast majority of people, probably less, there are less psychiatrists percentage-wise who would identify as religious or spiritual. But in the general population, I can't remember the percentage, maybe you know, but the majority of their patients will have a spiritual or religious belief that's important to them, that has a powerful effect in their lives, which really is their belief system will be a filter through which they create meaning and importance and the values in their life. And so what, if spiritual beliefs and values are important when you're well, they're even more important when you're ill. And to ignore them is to really ignore a whole chunk of, someone's identity, someone's support system, the way someone's filtering the world. So even if you don't agree with that, you really need to have the skills to engage in a conversation where you're exploring their beliefs and their perspectives in a way that doesn't make them feel like you're judging them or that you're going to, as you say, make yourself seem even more crazy, another a sort of a nail in the coffin. There are lots of quotes from patients where they say, I'm not going to talk about God or what I think's going on, because they'll just up my medication, stuff like that. So it's trying to break down that stigma, I suppose, in the same way as it would be the stigma of sexuality, and all that, all the things that maybe mark us out as different. But I think spirituality and spiritual and religious beliefs are very, very personal. I think they're really at the core of people's ways of thinking and ways of experiencing the world. And they're not going to share them if they don't feel safe, if they don't trust you. So I think it is a skill to be able to talk to someone about that aspect of your life and feel you're not going to be, it's not going to be held against you.
Yeah. David Peters, who's a mutual friend, we were talking about this, and we were talking about the argument. This was quite a while ago. We were talking about the arguments that can happen inside healthcare and medicine between the spiritual and the atheistic. And he said the solution to those arguments, especially between medics, was always to take the conversation into what does compassionate care look like? Because then it didn't really matter whether you believed in spirituality or did not believe in it. You were both grounded in the need to care for your patient. And the best kind of care was compassionate and listening and person-centered. And that conversation always grounded the differences into shared
Yeah,
approaches.
that certainly brings you into common ground, and I think the Royal College of Psychiatrists is trying to address that. There's a lovely book called Intelligent Kindness that came out a few years ago by a pair of psychiatrists, and I think that's informed a lot of the college's work as well. And well, I've actually retired from psychiatry, but I have trained as a mindful self-compassion teacher. So I find what I'm doing more and more now is teaching people self-compassion, and especially medical, the medical profession. I think it's not good at looking after itself, and the whole, well, the whole science of compassion, which is what these dialogues about, is a very deep one, but it's a, I would say it's also a really spiritual one. You can talk about compassion in terms of brain function, and you can talk about it in, you know, in terms of evolution and things like that. But to me, the heart of it is that my true spiritual nature is love, and really compassion is a manifestation of a truth about me as a spiritual being.
Well, the big question there, isn't it, in terms of the philosophy of it, is when we give compassion to ourselves, when there's an aspect of our psyche that gives compassion to ourselves, is that part of ourselves that can give compassion to ourselves, is that part of us an extension of the brain and the nervous system? Like a dog licking its leg when it's wounded, Or is it part of the evidence of the fact that there's a witnessing consciousness that belongs to a different sphere of a different, what's the right word, field of energy?
Good, very good question, William. I think it's both. You know, I think it's two-way traffic, and that's the interesting thing about the mindful self-compassion thing, is that I think you can draw on that universal compassion and that deep original nature of the self, of being love, and if you like, your higher consciousness. I think you can draw on that. But that's possibly, you know, quite a tough call for some people. I think you can also do self-soothing. You can hold your own hand, and you can do all kinds of stuff with your breath and your body, which is also soothing. And so the nervous system itself is, it's two-way traffic. So it's soothing the soul, and the soul can soothe the body, if you like. So maybe it's not helpful to make it either or, and just use all tools available.
Yeah, I think the issue for most people is in the context of evolutionary psychology, in that context, yes, what's built into us is to give compassionate care to something that's little and vulnerable and needs it, because that's the way our species survives. But what's not built into us is to perceive ourselves as requiring that same compassion and care. So it's a different set of the plasticity of the brain needs to be nudged and massaged and molded, and the neural grooves need to be set up so that you go, oh, wait a minute, that same instinct I've got for something little and vulnerable out there is the one that I need to give to myself. And
Well, that I think that what you're leaning into is the kind of bigger picture question, because you know, you say if you put it in the schemata of evolutionary psychology, that is one thing. There are other schematas, which people might use, which could say that, you know, life goes in, there's a sort of cyclical aspect to life, and maybe the soul comes in, and when we talk about old souls, maybe this is it, and as it's taking birth and rebirth, it's losing energy, and it loses the capacity for that, it loses that power of love that's intrinsic to it, or it ceases to recognize it. So you know, you can keep going back further and further, and depends on what lens you're using, or what schemata you're using to interpret the information, if you like, or understand what's really going on here. So,
yeah, I hear that, but I generalize from my own inner experience, I suppose, and it's been a training for me. I needed to train myself to give kindness to myself, to practice metta to myself.
For sure. I think you're right. We have lost that capacity, or we haven't. We could either say you've lost it, or you haven't learnt it, or evolution hasn't emphasized it to you. But for whatever reason you give to it, in a sense, whatever background theology you're using, it's still a practice that has to be developed, and it's not easy for most people. That very simple exercise that you do at the start of the Mindful Self-Compassion course, where you take people into a visualization and you just say you're with a friend or a loved one and something bad's happened to them, or they're hurting, or they've made a mistake, or they're failing, and just imagine you're there, and what are you saying, and what are you doing, and how are you feeling? And people are really into it, and they're giving people hugs, and they're holding their hands, and they're listening, and they get that. And then you say, okay, now you're suffering in some way, and you've made a mistake, or something bad's happened, or you failed, and how do you respond to yourself? What are you saying to yourself? What are you doing? How are you feeling? And that simple exercise, honestly, I've had people just burst into tears. I've had people run out of the room because it's like suddenly they go, whoa, I'm just so horrible to myself. I know how to do it with other people, but actually it really shines that spotlight on that, how often we can have that inner critical voice, or that those learned early childhood patterns that get repeated subconsciously, that we all struggle with from from time. It's a very
My take on that has always been that it's not natural to do that, and it's a learnt behavior. And I'm not sure that we ever had it. I see nothing in history that demonstrates to me that humanity as a species has had it. Of course, there have been nuns and monks and carers who've learnt it through practice. But in my experience, because I teach it a lot as well, is that people need to develop it as a rhythm and not just turn it on when they're in distress, but that have it as part of a daily practice, lying in bed, just giving themselves some care. And I remember when, I don't remember, I read a book called The Endorphin Effect quite a long time ago. And one of the things that really grabbed me was when one of the people in the Nobel Prize team that had discovered endorphins, he was on a Horizon program. This is what turned me onto it, BBC Horizon program. And there was this guy from one of the labs who was wearing a white coat and a stethoscope. And he was asked, what kind of people produce the most endorphins? And he said, it was white coat, clipboard, very, very bureaucratic, very admin manager. He said, well, quite embarrassed, a little smile. And he said, well, it's people who seem to have, they seem to have a little twinkle in their eyes. And they manage to keep that twinkle when they're in trouble. Put in another language, have a good humored relationship with yourself when the shit hits the fan, But it's difficult to practice. So where's psychiatry going to go now? Now that it's got mushrooms turning up in it, and then people taking. I mean, I've got some colleagues in the States who are using ecstasy as a kind of gentle everything out, and then mushrooms, and then people have a full 24-hour therapeutic session to melt through their stuff. But that's hugely time-consuming and energy-consuming, and psychiatry, like every other aspect of the NHS, is overwhelmed, understaffed. People don't have time to give attention and care.
I don't see myself as a spokeswoman for all of psychiatry by any means, but I think for myself, my heart goes out to friends and family who've got children or relatives or partners who are going through mental health challenges and struggles, and I can see they're not necessarily getting the help, the best help that they can. It's really, really hard. But I think we can all see at the moment the NHS is a bit like that all round. And I guess as much as you can look after yourself, the better, really. I don't think we can rely so much on professionals. And I think that's why there is a lot of emphasis now on well-being and self-help and all the things that probably a lot of the people on this call tonight do and offer to people, is how to maintain your own well-being and physical health. I mean, I got myself a personal trainer because I felt I really needed to do, take care of my body better, and I needed some help with that. So I think the kind of courses that are out there, the learning some kind of meditation practice that suits you, that resonates with you, all the things we've learned through lockdown and COVID about community and friends and connecting and nature and gardening, as much as you can do and look, do these things for yourself, then hopefully you won't need a psychiatrist. I think that would be my advice. And maybe that's a little segue. I don't know, William, if you wanted to mention, but during lockdown, myself and Jan Oko did write a book.
Yeah, show it. Have you got the cover there?
I've got the cover there. Yeah.
Love people. Stillness in the storm. Yes.
So in that, I think where I've put my energy is trying to create products, books, meditation commentaries. We did an app called Happy Dote for health and social care professionals, which is free, which are little 3-minute commentaries to try and act as an antidote to the stress that you're going on, that people could do on the job. And I think you're absolutely right. That's the key to a lot of compassion practices, is learning to soothe yourself or to have some kind of response. I mean, it sounds really simple, and I'm sure you teach this as well, but for me, when I did the course, and they did something called a self-compassion break, which is just, this is a moment of suffering. We all go through this. May I be kind to myself. So now, if I'm having an argument with my husband, rather than launching back and I just go, this is a moment of suffering. May I be kind to myself. Or an argument with anyone, really, when you can feel you're about to be triggered, or something is, you're aware that things are upsetting you, just to do that first, do that. And it just has to become a habit. You have to learn how to give yourself kindness in the moment and not wait till after work or your holiday. It's too far removed from the event. So I think any practices that you can have that really remind you of whatever you feel compassion is, whether you feel it's your true spiritual original nature, whether you feel it's your soothing endorphin oxytocin system in your brain or your parasympathetic nervous system, however, whatever makes most sense to you, just to use it, trigger it, involve it in the moment in looking after yourself. So yeah, this book is available from the Janki Foundation website, and it's got some very good tools for doing that. And I noticed, did you want to have question and answer, William? Is that part of the session, or how do you?
We can open it to that, but there's a couple of things, and then we'll see if you've got questions, people, stick them in the chat box, and then I'll carry on talking with Sarah, and you put stuff in the chat box if you want to. Maybe Sarah, before we end, do you have an exercise? I hadn't, this is I'm springing this on you.
You are.
Yeah, I'm springing this on you. Do you have a meditation exercise that you use so often that you could just go, oh, I know what we could end with? If not, don't worry. I'm startling you with a request that I didn't rehearse.
Yeah, there's one I do completely off the top of my head called Inner Sanctuary. If would you like me to do that?
Let's do that in a bit.
Okay.
There's one question I think would be really helpful for us, because it's to do with old age, dementia, that whole arena. Do you have any helpful counsel for those of us either moving into our senior years or caring for parents, relatives in their senior years, who as they lose healthy brain function may exhibit symptoms of what looks like dementia? Do you have any helpful, tell us what to do?
Well, that's a whole other lecture. Yes. I don't know if I'm an expert on that. I think it, you know, growing old is not easy. You know, not many people manage to do it gracefully and with a lot of dignity. I think, you know, the pain often is with arthritis and all kinds of things. It's really hard because you're diminishing. It's a sense of diminishing sense of self and how you're valued and how you're seen. And your body's not working very well. So someone called it ever-decreasing circles. But I think in connecting with people who are going through that, one of the most important or most useful things, I remember working with someone in my team who used validation therapy, because it's so easy to keep correcting people when they're dementing, and because they'll get it wrong all the time but think they're right, and you can lose a lot of energy going, no, it's not Saturday, it's Thursday, and it's, you know, you're in your home, or you're this or you're that. And the whole principle of validation therapy is really just because every time you correct them, they're feeling that it makes them feel like they're doing something wrong or they're diminished in some way. So you have to not work on logic really, but try and use that, whatever information they've given you, to create a connection or a conversation. So, oh, so you think it's Thursday, and Thursdays were really important days for you, weren't they? Because that's when grandma used to come and, you know, give you a present or something. Somehow see what the thread of is for them and turn it into a positive. So you're validating them and their existence and their value.
Yeah.
So I think that's very powerful.
There's one question from, which says, I'd love some resources about Alzheimer's and spirituality. Are there any that come to mind, Sarah?
There are certainly people who've written books about it. I've got books on my bookshelf here. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but I'm sure if you Google them, you could find them. But ways of being with people. And for me, I think because in my meditation, there's a very powerful practice of looking soul to soul. It's like you experience yourself as spiritual energy and you connect with the spiritual energy of another person, and you can still, and you're sending love and you're sending peace in a way. You can calm people down through your energy, and I'm sure anyone who's a spiritual healer will have experienced that. So it's an intentional connection, and I had patients who really had stopped speaking. They were, you know, in some senses you could say they looked like vegetables. They weren't interacting in the normal way. And the thing that can break through with people like that too is music. You know, music is reaching them in a way that other things don't. But you could connect with them with that spiritual energy, that kindness, with that energy of love.
That's lovely. Just to say, I don't know if you're looking at the chat box at all. There've been a few suggestions of some books, and I know Maggie Littorell's book on Alzheimer's, The Gift of Alzheimer's, is one that I would recommend and should have remembered.
Yep.
And John Swinton's Spirituality and Alzheimer's, and then a book called Ambiguous Loss by Dr. Pauline Boss is also. So they've got. So anybody's looking in the chat box, and I'm about to put into the chat box Sarah's.
There's another book that I chaired the book launch for this year, was called Present with Suffering, Liz McCormack and Nigel Wellings. It's a Buddhist kind of perspective, but it's excellent, I would say, on just being with suffering and loss and grief and
You know, I typed it in and I spelt it as resent with suffering
present with suffering.
instead of present. I'm so sorry, people.
I'd
That's
recommend
just awful, isn't it?
And I think some people mentioned position statements, and yes, the Royal College of Psychiatrists have a spirituality position statement, as does the WPA. So they're available as well.
Oh, and someone else is. LJ Moss has also asked, got any hints about Alzheimer's and when the older person becomes angry and violent?
I think that's very difficult.
Yeah.
Think you need a lot of self-compassion when you have people like that, because it's especially when it seems, I think people who are sort of have dementia and are still quite benign are easier to manage. But when their kind of personality changes and they become very angry and upset, it's very, very challenging indeed.
Yeah.
I don't know that there are any easy answers. I mean, hopefully, occasionally we would need to use medication just to take the edge off things. And sometimes,
Yeah. We have to have a very strong center to be able to deal with abuse and anger. It's difficult.
there's been a. I mean, the whole Alzheimer area is, the sensory, using different sensory modes, having sensory stimulation rooms where they have interesting colors and sound,
Yeah.
things like that, all that. I mean, so many things have been tried, and I think it's there's a vast literature out there.
So listen, let me just give a hint to some of the folk out there who are not techies. What you can do if you go into the chat box, any piece of text in the chat box, you can copy and paste into a Word doc. So just to say to you, if you scroll back up the chat box, you'll come to the five recommendations resources that Sarah gave to me to put in the chat box. I'm going to put them in again. I'm going to repeat them. And you can just go into the chat box, mark it up the same way you would any other piece of text, and copy and paste it to another doc. You may not be familiar with doing that, but you can do that. I'm going to ask you now, Sarah, to take us into that exercise, because I think that would be a wonderful. And I know I've surprised you with it, but I think it would be. I'd love to experience it with you.
Okay, so this is something that I do for myself or when I'm just with a group, just to really bring us into the present moment and take us to that safe place within. So if you just start by noticing, sitting comfortably, taking a few deep breaths, having your eyes open or closed or half closed. Just see what sounds are coming to your ears. What is the sound that's in your environment? Might be muffled noises from another room or traffic or relative stillness. What am I hearing? Then just bringing it a little closer in, scanning my body and seeing where I'm holding on to any tension. How's my body feeling? And if I notice that my shoulders are tense or my neck, just letting it go, just releasing that tension. Coming closer in and connecting with my breath. Noticing the gentle rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. And how soothing that rhythm can be, just noticing the gentle rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. Coming closer still, just moving into my internal landscape and noticing what feelings are arising. Noticing those feelings and accepting them. I may be tired or anxious or feeling quite good. Just allowing and accepting. Noticing my thoughts as if I'm standing on a riverbed and thoughts may be coming and going, but I don't catch a train of thought. I step back from the riverbed. I turn and walk into a clearing. Lying down on the warm grass. I just feel completely still. And silent. As I travel deeper and deeper into my core, I notice there is stillness. There is peace. There is love. In fact, I am peace. I am love. And from this still center, I feel a connection to the ocean of love. Connection to the ocean of compassion. A connection to divine love. And this is reflecting my true self, my true nature. And then gradually, as I come back, taking a few deep breaths, as I leave this inner sanctuary and come back to the manifest world. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. I think that's a beautiful way to end this session. No more to be said. Everybody goes on to gallery view. You go on to gallery view, then maybe give Sarah just a wave. Wave of thank you.
Oh, now I can see you all.
Yeah, everybody was waving at you. Okay, so thank you, Sarah, for a wonderful evening, wonderful conversation. Blessings, everybody.